Morning, everyone. I'll reconvene the hearing of the district, proposed district plan. This is hearing stream 3, historic heritage and protected trees. Just before we start this, Scott, Mr. Senderman, could you just tell us the evidence that is to be tabled, please, and we'll take that now.
Sure. So, Jim Smith and Federated Farm.
There's no public here, I won't bother with introducing everyone.
It's like it's just us.
Yes.
Good morning, sir. Good morning, commissioners. Just to ask some paper, just make sure we've all got the same documentation in front of us. We have filed a synopsis of legal submissions, which I will refer to briefly this morning. On Friday, we filed a set of legal submissions. I'll refer to that also. A case book with one case in it. And then, in response to the minute from Friday requesting further information, you have in front of you three separate documents. The first is information about the profile poles on site at Threepwood.
Can I just say that having had a look at that quickly before we opened the hearing, it doesn't appear to relate to the poles that we saw. and it might pay.
Ms. Jones will have the answer for that.
Yes.
My understanding is that there are poles there for different reasons.
Including one behind one of the buildings that has been referred to, which is off the map shown here.
Okay. Ms. Jones will be able to explain her understanding of those poles, but it's just not for one consent. Some of them are for pre-lodgement discussions, which are ongoing with the council.
Yep. Okay. Thank you. I'll clarify that before.
The second piece of information, which is titled on the front, that is also in response to Friday's minute regarding the location of the Brunswick Flower Mill site. And any questions on that, I would suggest a best directed to Mr. Holt in terms of technical questions. And I understand the question was really about what is actually protected. And the third, we have the Heritage Inventory Register. This information is an extract from the wider set of information that the council holds. This is only on the listing that it is submitted on, consistent with Friday's minute.
Yes.
I just want to just make a comment on that, and we will file an electronic copy of this with a covering memorandum just explaining this information. But the assessments have come from different locations, and Ms. Jones does talk about this in her section 42A, but there are three sets of work. One is the work undertaken by Jackie Gillies and Associates prior to, that was looking at the listings in the operative plan and assessing the potential listings of new features prior to notification of the proposed plan. That was taken around 2015. There is also assessments taken by Ms. Rebecca Reed of Telltale Limited, and these were taken as part of Plan Change 3. So they were undertaken around 2005. And then the third input is some work undertaken by University of Otago history students in conjunction with the Wakatipu Heritage Trust. and the council. And the disclaimer really relates to that work from those students. And Ms. Jones can explain further, and we'll put it in the memorandum as well.
Just clarification, is this information available to the public readily?
It is not available in one piece like you have in front of you, and it wasn't contained in a link to section 32 at notification in one spot.
I'm just wondering how the owners of any of the sites would be aware of this information.
My understanding is it's all publicly available, but it's, as you say, and as you mentioned in your minute, it wasn't part of, didn't form part of Section 32. Mm-hmm. That was not quite, but it was used to assess the listings prior to notification.
Okay, we can explore that perhaps with those terms a little bit.
Yes. So that is all the information you should have from me. So just turning to the opening submissions that were filed on Friday. They should be read together with a synopsis of submissions that were filed earlier, and I also referred to the legal submissions that were filed in the strategic directions hearing, because they cover in more detail the statutory tests that are relevant to this review. And for the sake of conciseness, they have been repeated in these legal submissions. In terms of the evidence that's been filed by submitters, it is relatively limited, and at the time of filing these submissions, we had looked at the majority of it, and the council officers and technical witnesses have in their highlights packages, which have been filed with you, the two pages, have commented on some of the evidence that's been filed. And I've also asked them that they respond orally in terms of the evidence of Jackie Gillies that was filed on Friday as well to assist the panel. There are matters that the Section 42A writers agree with in terms of what has been filed from submitters. So that is relevant in terms of there is some change from what was filed in the Section 42A report. So we'll do our best to make that clear to you from the outset where some additional changes are accepted. In terms of the scope of these chapters, the two chapters, there have been some submission points that council officers have recommended be deferred to other chapters. The first is submissions on two rules that relate to subdivision. They are rules 26.6.2 and 26.6.21. The council's position on those rules is that they should be contained in chapter 27, which is the subdivision chapter. And those submission points made on subdivision relating to heritage have and will be transferred across to the subdivision chapter and will be considered in the Section 42A report. The other matter to note is that Plan Change 50, the geographic area that's covered by Plan Change 50, was withdrawn by the council in October 2015. And the effect of that is that all provisions in the proposed plan that relate to that geographical area have been withdrawn. And there were some listings included in the notified chapter, including Glenarm Cottage and some trees. So the effect of that variation is they've come out of the two chapters. So turning now to section three of the fuller submissions, here we address a limited number of legal matters that were have arisen through evidence. The first is the Burns Law. A memorandum was filed by Real Journeys challenging the jurisdiction of the rules that were applicable to the listing of the Burns Law. And essentially they submit and we agree that the rules case to protect the dunes or our occupiers. So the position as set out in that memorandum is accepted by council. And as such, the listing, that particular listing, will be removed from the inventory and the council's right to reply. In terms of the slipway, Ms Black's evidence on behalf of Rural Journeys questions the appropriateness of the slipway listing, and that it's not a static feature or a building. It's not entirely clear which part of the listing the evidence is referring to. The item 3 that the slipway includes, the slipway and the cradle, and includes the winch house and the former boiler. The legal counsel for Rural Journeys in the memorandum that they filed questioning the Burns Law has not challenged the listing of the slipway. Council's position is there's no concerns there in terms of the legality of that listing. And at paragraph 3.3 through to 3.6, I cover there why it is the council's position that that listing should remain. In terms of the byways of the rule, section 2 of the RMA defines historic heritage as natural and physical resources that contribute to an understanding and appreciation of New Zealand's history and cultures. And this encompasses the term historic structures. Structure is then defined in section 2 of the RMA as meaning any building and equipment and which is fixed to land. And when you turn to the beams of the slipway and the winch house, they fall within the meaning of buildings as defined in section 8 of the Building Act 2004. The council submits that the cradle and the former boiler reasonably fall within the term equipment contained within the structure definition. And although the cradle moves itself moves up and down the slipway, the cradle is fixed permanently to the slipway, both elements are man-made, and the slipway itself is fixed to land. And the one case that is in the casebook that's referred to in Rural Journeys Memorandum, that, although slightly different factual circumstances, found that it was enough for a boat to be permanently moored for it to be a structure fixed to land. So that is just an example of the court accepting something more extreme in terms of what is a structure. Mr. Richard Knott's evidence is that the slipway and other elements have the necessary heritage characteristics to be listed, and I just note there that Rural Journeys hasn't provided any technical evidence opposing that listing. And Mr. Farrell, in terms of his planning evidence for Rural Journeys, also hasn't challenged the listing, but he considers the appropriate category. Paragraph 3.8, I refer to some historic consenting issues, also related to the slipway. Mr. Farrell, in his evidence, has raised the history of consenting, and he states in his evidence that until recently, Rural Journeys has not been required to obtain any resource consents or planning permissions to operate, maintain, or upgrade the Burns Law or the slipway, and then refers to the council intervening by requiring resource consents for these works in September 2015. The slipway is listed as a Category 2 protected item in the Operative District Plan, and under the Operative Plan rules, any alteration requires a discretionary consent, any demolition a non-compliant resource consent, and it is only if works fall within general maintenance, then no consent is required. The slipway is, of course, located on Council Reserve Land, and on 9 September 2015, the council was alerted to unconsented works being undertaken on the slipway, and I've attached some photographs that were taken at the time, which clearly showed the work that was being completed or being done with no consents. And in particular, I know the hardwood beams have been removed and replaced with steel beams. Replacement of steel beams was in progress. And that is activity that is beyond the concept of general maintenance. Rural Journeys was instructed to stop works on account of the need to apply for a resource consent under the Operative Plan. And we record here that council had has a legal obligation to enforce the ODP, and the risks, costs and inconveniences referred to by Mr. Farrell in this evidence resulted from Royal Journey's failure to obtain a resource consent. Royal Journeys sought retrospective consent, and there was no prosecution or abatement or infringement notices issued. And just on, finally on that matter, which is to record simply from a factual perspective what happened, council does not understand Mr. Farrell's statement about the intervention in September 2015, being after Royal Journeys made its submission, which is dated October 2015. And any inference that there's a link between the Royal Journey submission on the proposed plan and matters of monitoring and enforcement of heritage provisions of the operative plan are not accepted by the council. Turning to heritage landscapes, this is a refined scope issue. Mr. Vivian for New Zealand Tungsten Mining Limited does state and his evidence that he doesn't consider the heritage landscapes unnecessary at all in the plan, but then goes on to accept that there's no scope for the removal of those overlays, and council agrees with that position in terms of scope, and in terms of merit, considers them to offer an appropriate level of additional protection. And that is something that you'll hear from Mr. Knott and Ms. Jones about this morning. Turning to the trees chapter, the purpose of chapter 32 is to promote the protection of trees that have been identified as providing significant benefits to the district, and also to that contribute to the character and amenity of the Arrowtown Residential Historic Management Zone. The amendments to the RMA to the tree rules are relevant and have required some changes to the proposed plan compared to the operative plan. Of course, sections 76, 4A and 4B provide that a rule in a district plan may not restrict the felling, trimming, damaging or removal of any tree or group of trees in an urban environment allotment. Of course, the definition is highly relevant there, unless that tree or group of trees is described in a schedule to the plan. The allotment needs to be specifically identified in the plan as well. So in the proposed chapter, paragraph 4.2, A to C, it provides for protected trees, and these are protected by rules in Table 1, and the trees themselves are identified in the schedule in 32.8. Character trees. These are listed in Schedule 32.7, and they are the Schedule of Character Trees in the Arrowtown Residential Historic Management Zone. And finally, the chapter provides for trees that are protected for those that are not located in an urban environment allotment, which means they don't have to be specifically listed in the schedule. The only evidence that's been filed, the only technical evidence that's been filed on the listings is that of the council. And I just note there that Rural Journeys has challenged one listing, and that's the evidence of Miss Black, which is company evidence. But there isn't any technical evidence in support of that listing. So we have five witnesses that will be presenting evidence to you this morning. Before I move on to that, sir, are there any questions that you would like to
ask? Yes. firstly, this just arose from the minute that we passed to the council on Thursday, I think it was, or Friday. Regarding the link at the back of Mr. Knott's evidence to a whole lot of other information, it's not helpful to us to do that. I'm just passing this on because that's almost like hiding it, and we're not here to look for Easter eggs, I'm afraid. It would be better to have it as a separate appendix, just electronically available. I'm sure that if we missed it, because we don't go through every page looking for hidden links, the members of the public may also have missed it. Second question is a more broad one, and I need to ask you this, Ms. Cockrell and Ms. Jones, because as a consultant, I don't think Ms. Jones is truly able to answer it. Objective 2652 and policy 26521 both suggest some sort of incentive or advantage given to heritage buildings and resource consent situations. But in looking through the provisions, there is nothing in there which provides any incentive for owners of heritage buildings, such as enabling uses which the zone may not normally provide for. And I'm just wondering if that is purposeful of the council to not do that, or an oversight.
I don't have the answer to that question right now.
No, that's why I asked you. Yes, because I think that from our point of view, that's quite important. We're both Commissioner Nixon and I are familiar with provisions in other plans, thinking of Christchurch and Auckland in particular, where special provision is made to enable proper use to be made of heritage buildings to create economic viability. And that seems to not be the case in this district. The final matter I want to ask you to consider is with respect to the protected trees, whether there's an inconsistency in the plan which weakens the veracity of the plan by protecting species of trees which by chapter 34 it's made a prohibited activity to plant those same trees because of their wildland status. And I raise this in particular not just to do with the Real Journeys submission in respect of the Sycamore and Bolton Peak Station, but in a more general sense through the district, the trees that are protected are the more mature trees which are going to be spreading more seeds than other minor trees, and perhaps more of a problem in terms of the direction of the district plan. And I'm not sure that protecting trees which are considered wildlands is consistent with the strategic direction policies and objectives.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like you to put your mind to that and tell us how we can overcome that conundrum, if you like.
Yes, okay, thank you for that information. It has been raised in one of the submissions, and therefore in the evidence, and Mr. Spencer has looked at that issue in particular and related to the relation to Real Journeys submission, which you've referred to. But Ms. Laws is sitting behind me, so she would have taken note of that question, and we'll discuss it today before we call Ms. Laws as well. And it's something that we can cover in more detail in the reply as well.
Yes. Well, I think it's quite important because I can't remember the policy exactly now, but there was a provision in the either chapter 3 or chapter 6 which was quite explicit about prohibiting wildland species. And I don't recall there being a similar provision in the strategic directions chapter about protecting those same species. Mm-hmm. And so the plan needs to be consistent in the way that it's fixed to strategic objectives and policies.
Did you have any other questions,
Yes, I have a few I'd like to follow up, and again, they may be able to be addressed further in the planning evidence as well. First one was is that the council has quite clearly come out in favour of having a listing in the plan, in other words, rules in the plan on archaeological sites, which would be in addition to the powers the Historic Places Trust have, and I realise those are limited in certain ways. From a legal perspective, I assume Parliament intended there be a code for protecting archaeological sites as specifically set out in the Historic Places Act. I'm just curious as to what would happen in a situation where the council and HBT came to a different conclusion, for example, or even could they come to a different conclusion. If they couldn't come to a different conclusion, I'm just wondering what the point of having a duplicate procedure actually is. Something that's been exercising my mind a bit.
Perhaps if I can take you to the synopsis of submissions that was filed, if you have that in front of you. So at paragraph 7 onwards, they address the relevance of the heritage of the Act, the Heritage Preserving Act, to this plan review process. And so set out there in paragraph 7 is the purpose of the HNZ PTA, and that is the promotion of the identification, protection, preservation and conservation of historical and cultural heritage of New Zealand. It is Section 5 of the Act that provides that Heritage New Zealand must maintain the list, the New Zealand Heritage List, and the list contains historic places, historic areas, Waitapu areas and Waitapuna. So Section 74 is of relevance to your question, and that specifically addresses the relationship between the Resource Management Act and the Heritage New Zealand Act. So under subsection 74, 2B11A, when preparing a district plan, a territorial authority shall have regard to any relevant entry on the list. That is the first link. Also of relevance, and this is set out in Mr. Knott's evidence in more detail, is that the Heritage Act doesn't provide any regulation in terms of this list. It's simply a list that Heritage New Zealand put together, and it is being used by councils to form the schedules that they put in their plan, and that is where the regulation kicks in as such. The exception is for archaeological areas that are pre-1900, and it is the Heritage Places Act that provides regulation for those specific pre-1900 areas. So the Heritage New Zealand Act is not in itself a code. It is the district plan that must provide for the protection of various historic areas of the necessary never lost significance. And it is the list that is the starting point for every council, but the list is not a comprehensive list. As you'll see from the evidence of Heritage New Zealand as well, they are entirely in support of the approach, well, almost entirely in support of the approach that the council has taken in terms of taking that list and moving it into its plan. And the evidence is quite helpful in terms of their support for where the council has landed.
Thank you.
Can I just simply ask? I think part of the point of Commissioner Nixon's question was the need for dual consents of an applicant. Is this a situation where the rules could be similar to that which we discussed in the rural zone with, I think it was clearance of indigenous vegetation on Department of Conservation land, where I think the council came back and said that where the Department of Conservation had granted an approval for such clearance, then that would be considered, it wouldn't remove the requirement for a consent, but it would make it somewhat simpler. I can't remember exactly what was done there. But I'm wondering whether there's a need for a duality, if you like. Mm-hmm. So I know there are different purposes and there are slightly different issues. But Heritage New Zealand does have the archaeological experts on board and the council doesn't.
Yes, in the rural hearing we looked at, I think it was some form of certification for that in terms of you've already held a concession. And I don't have the rule reply for
that.
My recollection, and I'm sure Mr. Barrow can correct me if I'm wrong, was that rule didn't go through to the reply. I might be wrong there, in its entirety, in terms of one was drafted to assist the hearings panel in its deliberations. That certainly occurred, but I can't remember the final rule that ended up in the council's decision.
I think something did come through in the reply.
It was essentially
identical
to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering whether some sort of similar arrangement could be written in this case. I mean, clearly, there is no value in consent being refused by the council when it's granted by Heritage New Zealand,
mm-hmm.
and vice versa. And the appeal rights on the Heritage New Zealand provisions are quite limited from memory. I haven't looked at them closely, but I suspect the council would be in a position possibly to appeal them. But I'd have to know about it.
Well, we can look into that all further. We'll have to also look into whether there's scope for that type of form to come into the chapter as well.
Well, even if there isn't scope, it's least something that if it seemed at the end of our deliberation sensible, we could recommend variation, something along those lines. But I'm happy to things that are out of scope to recommend variations or picking up on part two of the district plan.
My second question, again, one of these broad philosophical ones, I guess, and it comes down to, and I'm aware that under the operative plan there are prohibited activity status for some buildings, but thinking particularly in terms of private properties as opposed to publicly owned properties, there could be an argument that prohibited activity status is getting almost to the point of designation without compensation. And I'm just wondering what, in terms of Section 32, what the real effect of that might be, because at the end of the day, the council may find itself in a position where it has to issue a heritage order anyway. I think one example in this district was the miners' cottages in Arrowtown, where you can have all the regulation you like, but the owner just sits there and does nothing. The council eventually just had to step in, so it's not a guarantee that the building will be repaired or maintained or anything of that nature. Has that issue been given any consideration through this process, having prohibited status, particularly over private properties?
I don't believe it's an issue that has been live through the submissions, which is why it's not processed here in the Section 42A report at all.
No, but it has been. One submission has raised, I think it might be, name of the submitter now, Watertight Holdings, I think might be the one, where they've basically said we'll collapse everything into the same status as alterations that may or may not be covered by that. But I thought I'd ask that question anyway, because I'm just curious to know what that status will really achieve in practical terms, beyond what should be achieved through a heritage order.
Okay.
Maybe some of the plans.
With your legal, come back to you on that. It's not something that I've turned my mind to in terms of the issues that have been raised in the submissions. Taken on board.
Mm-hmm. There's only one other detailed question, maybe a negative again, I suppose, but in paragraph 5.8 of the officer's report, he makes reference to goals. Now, I don't know whether the plan as a whole has goals in them or a goal is defined. I guess I know this issue came up when I was working on the original Christchurch City plan back in the 90s, because they had initially started out with goals. I just worry that a cunning lawyer could come to a hearing, especially with the 104D, and say, oh, well, I'm not bound by those because there's no such thing as a goal. The only things they have to consider are objectives and policies. So again, I'm just wondering what the situation is with that.
The strategic directions chapter has goals within it. It is only the strategic directions chapter that has these goals. The status and appropriateness of the drafting of them as goals was something that's covered in some detail in that hearing, and also in the council's right to reply for that hearing. We can have a copy of that provided for you if that would assist. So in paragraph 5.8 of Mr. Joseph's report, it's referring to the goals and strategic directions chapter.
Yeah, probably that's right, yeah.
Yes.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll start with Mr. Knott.
Issues as I go through that that have come up in subsequent evidence. So in my evidence I consider the methodology for identifying heritage items to be included in the inventory of protected features in chapter 26 of the proposed district plan. I note that neither the notified chapter nor the section 32 report confirms the methodology that was used to add new items to the inventory or which should be used for the identification or assessment of new items to be added to the inventory. I recommend, as has Ms. Jones, that the chapter be amended to include the criteria which new items that are to be proposed to be included in the future should be assessed against. And effectively, that's the plan change 3, the PDP criteria, as set out in Appendix 3 in my evidence. Those items which are identified as meeting the criteria are then classified as fitting one of three categories, with each category recognising the relative significance of the building or item. These categories are defined in the Oxford District Plan, but not in the PDP. I recommend, as has Ms. Jones, that the PDP be amended to include a description of each category based upon but updated from the descriptions given in the ADP. In relation to that matter, if I could just go off script, there's been some suggested changes to the wording for Category 1 coming through in Jack Gilly's evidence. I have some concerns about that. If you actually read her suggestions, I think there may be a typo, because what she's not doing is identifying words that have been deleted. She's showing words to be added, but there is a word other deleted, and that word other is quite significant. If you look at the suggested wording for Category 1, which is in my paragraph 3.6a of my evidence in chief, I say it's often also extremely significant regionally and or nationally, and she's taken out the word often. And I think that actually makes a reasonable difference to it, because it could be that the argument comes forward that to be extremely significant regionally or nationally, you would have to be a Category 1 building with the Heritage New Zealand list. So I think having often opens it up to have other buildings which aren't Heritage New Zealand Category 1 on the list, which could indeed be the case. I will also respond to a number of site-specific submissions which have been made in relation to individual heritage items, including the inventory under 26.9 building structures and features and 26.10 archaeological sites. These relate to a range of issues including the request for an increase or decrease in categorisation, deletion from the schedules and suggested additional items to be added. I consider each of these items individually. In a number of cases where there is a sufficient level of information available to me for peer review, I'll make recommendations regarding whether I support or do not support the suggested changes. However, in some cases, insufficient information is available to be made a judgment, and in these instances, I recommend no alteration to the PDP. Then, if I could again go off script and just pick up two items which I felt there wasn't sufficient information available to me when I put my original evidence together. And this additional information comes forward from Jackie Gillies on the two of those buildings. That's item 59, which is the McNeil building. There's some good information available in Jackie Gillies' evidence, and having considered that, I do now agree with her that it should be a Category building. It was previously shared as Category 2, and that's because of the level of change which has taken place to the building in reasonably recent years.
Sorry, two or three?
It's down to three from two.
Right, because you said B or C, left confused.
Sorry, yeah, I'll just double check on my, again, my primary evidence on that. So that's on page 22, paragraph, starting at paragraph 5.54. And having seen additional information, I now agree with that submission. So the second building, which I now have additional information on, which I'm happy to accept, is item 101, which is the St. Peter's Church Parish Centre, the old vicarage. And again, having looked at the additional information available to me, I now accept the submission that should be a Catholic building.
Is that
going
from 3 to 2?
Yes. So there are some other buildings mentioned in Jackie Gillies' evidence, but I haven't considered those because, as far as I understood, they were beyond scope and haven't previously been submitted on, so I haven't made any comments upon those. I also respond to a submission asking for the Pick and Whistle building to be removed from the Queenstown Courthouse Historic Heritage Precinct. I note that the boundary of this precinct was amended by way of the notified version of the PDP and differs from the boundary shown in the ODP. One consequence of this is the Pick and Whistle building, which was previously partly within the precinct and the boundary ran directly through, well, diagonally through the building, is now fully within the notified version of the precinct. In my opinion, Pick and Whistle's building does not directly contribute to the heritage precinct, and I conclude that the boundary should be adjusted to remove the building from the precinct. In relation to the Glenorchy Heritage...
Before you go on from that,
sorry, yes.
Ms. Gillies and her evidence suggests that in moving the boundary, it should be on the face of the Pick and Whistle.
Yes.
To give enough space between that, the edge of the area and the existing buildings within it. Do you agree with that?
I do, and Ms. Jones and I double-checked that boundary. It appears that I think the intention on that plan was to draw it on the edge of the building. I think it's debatable because of the scale of the plan, because you're looking at an area when you're looking at rooms rather than faces, whether it is in the face of the building or not. But yes, I think that should be adjusted to make it very clear that the face, it goes to the face of the building. In relation to the Glenorchy Heritage Landscape Area, submissions seek the statement of significance and key features to be protected to be amended to reduce the features protected. I note the evidence of New Zealand Tungsten Mining Limited, but consider there is still insufficient understanding of the area to confidently reduce the key features to be protected. Therefore, I do not support the request for amendments, but do think that an appropriate heritage assessment could provide the needed clarity. Such an assessment could be relied on to determine whether the feature was a heritage feature in accordance with the rule 26.6.21. So just to expand upon that, if I may, they submitted a heritage assessment with their evidence. If you look at the boundaries of that heritage assessment, it doesn't correlate exactly to the boundaries of a heritage landscape area. So for that reason, I have concerns upon relying upon it. Equally, we don't know the scope of that report and of what the instruction was in relation to that report, because it was actually produced for another reason. But I do think that some sort of heritage assessment could provide significant greater clarity over which features are important and which features should be protected. So we're in a bit of a catch-22 where I think we have to keep, because of the lack of information, keep the plan broad to make sure things are captured and we don't exclude things. But I think in the future I could see an opportunity to potentially focus the protection and control on those features which are determined to really matter. But at the moment we don't, I believe, have the information that allows us to do that. So whether the plan could somehow be amended to allow that to come in subsequently is perhaps a debate for others rather than me. I also consider submissions made regarding objectives, policies and rules, as I now turn to. I confirm my support for the two rules relating to alterations, which is 26.6.5 external alterations and 26.6.6 internal alterations, but note that they both rely upon the statement works affecting the fabric or character of buildings and features. As there's currently no definition of fabric or features, I consider the rules unclear. I therefore suggest a new definition for heritage fabric or characteristics. I note that I have concerns regarding the practical use of the definition of second, which is currently included in the notified chapter, and confirm that providing an extended place provides greatest clarity on this matter. I accept that where an extended place does not exist, it's best to rely upon a more narrowly defined setting, and subsequently have recommended a narrower definition setting. I confirm I've reviewed existing extensive place where they're available, and that there's a couple of extensive places available within council records already, and I've also looked at the ones from Heritage New Zealand, and support the adopting those extensive places recommended in the revised chapter 26, which is included in appendix 1 of the section 42 report in this chapter. Sorry, is that 42A, isn't it? So that's my summary. But I'm sure this issue's clarification. Thank you.
Do we have any questions?
Yeah, I was going to ask the planning officer the issue about the place of the, because seating is a fairly well embedded term in terms of heritage protection in New Zealand, so it's a well understood term as being. The issue of extent of place seems to be a new one. I wasn't quite clear when I read through the evidence at the end of last week exactly what that meant, but I might take it that extent of place refers to a setting that might go beyond the legal boundary of a site, for example, or is it, how do I best understand that?
I think extent of place is more about actually defining the setting, effectively the setting by drawing the line. And I think drawing the line provides greatest clarity effectively, because anyone can look at a plan and very clearly understand how far things go. So, for instance, you may have a building which is on a very large legal parcel, but actually the setting of the building could be somewhat smaller. And so the amendments that are suggested to the setting, which is effectively the fallback position I suggest, really, does now confine the setting to be within that legal parcel, because I think we saw complications of having a setting which is much more open, as it was originally risen, which could extend, you know, quite some distance and impact upon within an urban area potentially a large number of other owners.
Right. So I'm going to take it from that answer that extended place means where you basically define the setting in plan form.
Yes, that's right, effectively.
Thank you. One question, it may be best to ask Ms. Jones this one, but I presume you're aware of the 30%, 70% concept where she suggested that you have full or partial demolition. Is that a concept you support, or is it something that's outside the scope of what your evidence is dealing with?
No, I think it's one which I've seen in practice elsewhere, and I'm happy to support that as a concept. I think that the line has to be drawn somewhere.
Yep.
To provide clarity for people, and I think that's a reasonable place to draw it.
Okay. Because I've tried to look at that issue in terms of some questions about trying to apply it to particular sites, so I've got a better understanding of it, and whether it's best to ask you that now or ask Ms. Jones.
I'm more than happy to respond to you if you have a question and see how far we go.
All right, let's do that then. Just trying to think of some of the sites we visited, and I'm not suggesting that figure is wrong. It's really educating me more than anything, I suppose. But I understand if it's more than 30% and less than 70%, you're looking at alteration, effectively, we define as an alteration. It's more than 70%, it effectively becomes full demolition. At least that's my understanding of how it's intended to work.
I'd have to pull out the wording, actually. I've called to get in front of you before I respond, shouldn't I? So I don't know whether I have the section 40. That's my topic. Is it section 42?
I think it's worth pursuing, because
if
push comes to shove, the resource consent hearing could become quite a
significant factor. Yeah, no, it's going to be useful to have it in front of me. If you have it in front of you, and to enable me to get to as speed as possible, do you have a page number?
No, I picked it up when I was reading through, and there are definitions on page 26.7.
I think rule 26.6.3(i) is the partial demolition, and that has the 30-70 explained in it.
I think it comes up twice in the rules.
It's in one of our respects as well, 26.3 with 3.
So if I just explore that a little bit better so I can understand what it's doing. If one were to think of a building like Arcadia, for example, which is a very large wooden structure, is that really designed to deal with a situation where you might have to replace a very high proportion of the external weatherboards, replace significant areas of flooring, that kind of thing, say to more than 30% of the volume or area? Is that the kind of thing we're thinking of here?
I think it would be. And there might also be potentially more recent extensions on the building which you would just want to take, but they're effectively covered, they're within the state of place or within the setting or physically linked, and it would cover those circumstances as well.
Yes, in the case of that particular one, it's got a remarkable sort of extension on it, which has got an indoor swimming pool, which is one of my unusual features of seeing with a dwelling like that, but there you are, that's what it is. And that I think has been excluded from the listing. But we also saw the bowling club over there in the Domain, which looks like a hardy plank extension, quite a large one on one end. That doesn't appear to be excluded, but one would have thought it would have much heritage value. I guess when I first saw that 70% figure, I would imagine there might be some out there who recoil in horror and say, well, you could demolish 70% of Arcadia, which I don't think that's what the rule's trying to do, is it? Although in theory you could probably get away with that. So I'm just wondering, on the face of it, it seems a very generous figure, and I realise that you've got to relate it to the definition of heritage fabric, because you might say, well, it's not actually 70%, because a lot of the stuff we're going to knock over isn't actually heritage fabric, it's 1960s hardy plank or whatever it might happen to be. But I just wanted to have a bit of a handle on how that seemingly generous figure was arrived at.
I think it also has to be seen against the the fact that we're talking about restricted discretionary, at least in terms of the category of that work. So
yeah.
I think, yes, it does sound generous, but equally, it's a trigger, isn't it? Rather than the decision, that's a trigger for a process. And so I think if we were in a position of saying, yes, that actually makes something permitted, I would share people's concerns about it, but it doesn't. It's just a trigger for a consent, effectively.
Okay, thank you.
Just following on from that, because if you look at what happened with the results of McNeill's Cottage, there was demolition that has effectively reduced the heritage value of that building quite significantly, and there's continual alteration. How do you feel about that?
But I think that just highlights the significance of having light activity status for it. Because clearly we have, you know, for instance, if we say McNeill's the changing of the windows, so the two windows in front of the doors, to door opening towards an alteration, still as a Category 3 building, that's an RD activity. So there is the ability to step in and control those changes. So now, as I said, I see these as the start of the process, given the categories we have here, rather than being the end of the process, because you have to go through that full assessment and consideration of the issues or those restricted discussion issues. But even so, they allow us to believe to fully consider the matter in hand. So, I'm not unduly worried about it. This is a trigger rather than a decision.
Brings me into the question I had with regard to the mining and the mining overlay. And one of the arguments that was put forward by the submitter was to do with an area being active and being used, thereby helping the heritage value of that area. And how did you feel about their argument about saying potentially by using this area or being accessing it, could actually actively enhance and protect the area?
I mean, certainly there's some benefits, isn't there? And I'll say in my evidence that all layers of history are important, and that includes the ones we're creating now. So, yes, I recognise and agree to an extent with what they say. And equally, having that the activity is bringing further money forward that can potentially be invested in other things you do want to retain and enhance within that area. But it has to be, I still believe it has to be considered as to whether it is appropriate and whether you're destroying something which is significant and should be retained, or how you then manage the thing immediately next door, through that process. And therefore, I think we have to have the correct rules in place to do that. And that comes back to my concern, particularly in relation to Glenorchy heritage landscape, that we don't, I believe, have a complete picture of what's significant and what isn't yet. And I guess really, the true answer to what you posed can't be known until you do know that. The true impact upon the heritage landscape of starting mining again in a specific location relies upon someone and the council in the end having a good understanding of the impact of that work.
Which then leads on to what the appropriateness of the heritage assessment, and is that something that can be contained within?
Yes, whether it's how that's perhaps moving to plan, recognising the fact that that inevitably at some point someone will have to do a heritage assessment there. If they're given a situation consenting, they'll have to do a heritage assessment. That might be very localised for a particular small area, or whether we should, or whether the panel should be recommending that they perhaps can look at the whole area before they even consider whether they're going to reopen a mine or do other work, because that might focus their direction if they've got two competing sites, for instance. So I just wonder whether there's the opportunity to perhaps allow them to go through a process first for that, you know, whether they choose to do so, they could do it either way. But I was just wondering whether that's worth considering.
Trust the process.
Just going back to this matter that Commissioner McLeod raised, that the 30% and whether with McNeill's cottage that would lead to other changes. Do you think that the 30% should be cumulative over time, or is it at each time someone does some work? Because that's a permitted activity which the council will not necessarily know about.
Yes, in terms of internal operations, for instance. Yeah, perhaps it should. I mean, I'd see benefits of it being cumulative on just one of the factors whether that will become cumbersome, and whether perhaps therefore the question is more whether internal versions of the capital can be built and should be diminished or otherwise. I think in the interest of allowing people to get on and do things, perhaps it should remain committed, but it perhaps needs to be cumulative, as you say.
Well, I'm just wondering because clearly, if you can do 30%, and that's not considered partial demolition, which is what I understand the rule to say, then 2016, and then in 2017, you can do another 30%, well, you've done 60%.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2018, you do another 30%, you've done 90%, which was called demolition otherwise. So I'm just wondering whether it should be termed as from the date of the plan or something. Presumably, with heritage items, the council would like to keep track of what's happening with those particular buildings. And it was perhaps something that Ms. Jones could put in mind too before we hear from her how we deal with that.
Yeah, because I mean, the only one that really relates to is those internal operations, isn't it? Category 1st. So I think the difficulty is, I agree, you're 100% correct. The difficulty is, of course, we could have had a building which has had more than 30% already, and then we started at the plan that everything was blank and becomes operative, and there we go again. But I think there's got to be, that's the only time we can really start it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think we've just got to live with the consequence of starting on a date, but I think you're right, being cumulative would be sensible.
Okay. Now, just turning to your evidence in chief. Just on page 28, dealing with the 3-foot stone buildings.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if you could clarify there whether you're agreeing with Ms. Gillies' split between category 2 and category 3 that she suggested.
Okay, let me just. Yes, in terms of the 3-wood and the building, stone buildings, it's rather confusing, I think, because of the change in the ODB to the BDB, where what I think is one of the stone buildings now has its own item being stabled, and as far as I can understand, that was part of the stone building before.
And what does this work? Because there's two stables.
The stables being the ones on the track going down to the lower.
The lower one.
The lower building, that's right.
Yes.
And the ones above is the wool shed.
Right.
I understand.
Yeah, I wondered about that, yes.
Yeah, so as you go in on the right, the bigger building with the extension, with the corrugated steel extension on it, is the wool shed. And then as you go down, you've got the stables, which is a smaller building, which has had a big opening put in it on the left-hand side of the car.
Yes.
So I think there would be some clarity in terms of item 70 splitting Fleetwood and the Wiltshire. Great, because I was saying 587, just above our clarify what I believe that covers. As I said, I believe that covers the homestead and state buildings now being a single state building being the watershed. And I think there would be clarity in splitting those.
Okay. Thank you. That was my only question.
Thank you.
I will take you through my highlight summary.
Yes.
And as Mr. Knott did, I will, if it's okay, I'll go off script and respond to the evidence as best I can to front foot some of that, if that suits you. Okay. While the structure of the notified historic heritage chapter remains largely unchanged, I've recommended relatively significant changes to the provisions themselves. The focus of the changes has been on providing stronger, more directive policies, reducing ambiguity and improving enforceability and certainty of the roles, defining the various heritage categories, providing evaluation criteria, and amending the inventory of protected features to ensure it is as accurate and clear as possible. I've done that in response to the expert evidence of Mr. Richard Knott. Various consequential changes have also been made to the planning maps. I'm happy to take you through those if you'd like me to at any stage. More specifically, the objectives are rephrased as outcome statements and a number of new policies are introduced to provide stronger and more detailed direction. The amended rules introduce separate rules for total and substantial demolition with different activity statuses and or different policies applying to each. The amended rules define the term heritage fabrical characteristics in order to improve certainty. The rules no longer include rules relating to subdivision, recommending instead that such rules reside in the subdivision chapter. The rules provide a more appropriate definition of setting, provide greater clarity as to what constitutes development, and when possible, extents of place are included in the inventory itself. The rules relating to heritage precincts are reformatted to be clearer. Statements of significance and key features are referred to in the rules and policies. And the all-encompassing development role has been deleted. I'll return to that at the end when I speak to O'Day's evidence. The rules relating to archaeological sites are more workable, clearly applying only to those sites listed in the PEP and no longer relying on obtaining authority prior to applying for resource consent. And the rules related to heritage landscapes have been refined and no longer include an all-encompassing development rule. See, the categories of some items in the inventory have been amended and new features and archaeological sites added where sufficient information existed in order to enable Mr. Knott to undertake a well-informed peer review. Three features have been removed, one because it no longer exists, another because it's more appropriately listed as an archaeological site, that being the Brunswick Flour Mill, and another because it is in the Plan Change 50 area, which is again Elm Cottage, and is therefore now not part of Stage 1 of the District Plan Review, but rather is regulated or managed through the operative district plan provision. For completeness and consistency with Appendix 2 of the Section 42A report, paragraph 21.9 of the Section 42A report should also recommend that 1315 Stanley Street not be listed in the inventory due to a lack of information supporting such a listing. So that's an omission in the 42A report that should be corrected. Subject to incorporating a number of the specific changes suggested in submitted evidence, as I shortly turn to, I consider that the amended provisions as recommended in my evidence are the most appropriate way to protect historic heritage while enabling and encouraging ongoing use and appropriate adaptation. I accept Ms. Jane O'Day's recommended amendments to the rules relating to archaeological sites as outlined in her paragraphs 13.8, 13.11 and 13.13. I consider these are an improvement on those recommended in the 42A report. I've got to note that it is beyond scope, in my view, to amend the Chapter 21 signage in the manner that Ms. O'Day suggests. That chapter has not been notified in Stage 1 of the PEP. I've got one additional comment in response to her evidence, and that is simply that I accept that adding a note cross-referencing to the subdivision section in the general rules table is acceptable, in my view, if the commissioners consider it's necessary. She discusses the fact that that may add some clarity when people are reading through the rules. I do note that it's already referred to in the district-wide sections that one should. It should already be clear there to the reader that
they're
at the subdivision section.
But those referred you to everything else in the plan, so they're not overly helpful.
Well, I'll come to that. No responding to the So that adds clarity to the reader. No problem with making sure people realise they need to go to the subdivision section for that. Turning back to my written work, based on the commentary of Mr. Kerry Vivian's evidence regarding inconsistency between the earthworks definition of the ODP and that of the PDP, in paragraphs 81 to 85, I agree that it may be necessary to exclude mining from the earthworks rule 26.6.21.
Just on that point, isn't that inconsistent with your previous paragraph? Chapter 26.
The earthworks rule within rule 26.6.21, which is in the heritage section.
Yes, but the earthworks.
Pardon?
There's no earthworks chapter in the proposed district plan either, is there?
No, that's the problem. I mean, that's right. That's why what he's asking for, what Mr. Williams is suggesting, is that in the earthworks rule in here, there's a whole debate about whether there should be earthworks rules sitting in here at all, but we have one sitting in here. Which refers to earthworks, which sits in the heritage section. And I'm saying, given that the PDP definition of earthworks doesn't exclude mining activities in the way that the ODP does, he explains it quite well in his evidence. If we take a view that mining, etc., should not be subject to the earthworks rules, then we need to exclude it within this rule 26.6.21 in the manner that he suggests. If we're being consistent with the council's final decision on plan change 49, I think it is, which is the recent earthworks plan change, which is going to council soon, from my understanding. So regarding the civilian suggestion in paragraph 4.27, I do not favour listing the other relevant zones in section 26.4 of the chapter, but if the panel considered it useful, I'd support potentially adding a note clarifying that the heritage rules are an overlay and not a zone, and as such the underlying zone provisions also apply in all cases. addition to my paragraph 5 of my highlights, just so that you're aware, I'm happy to accept the changes to various objectives and policies suggested by Mr. Vivian in his paragraphs 35 and 51, and his change to 26.25 Add the word maintained, be consistent with the underlying policy. In paragraph 4.51, he suggests replacing the word minimised with mitigated, and I'm happy to accept that. And he makes various changes to the statement of significance in this paragraph 4.65, which I'm happy to accept, with the exception of he talks about the mining in his last sentence. He says it's recognised that it is highly likely that exploration mining will recommence. My view is it would be preferable to simply say likely. What my initial wording is, there's the potential for it to recommence. The only other comment to add to that paragraph 5 in regard to Mr. Vivian's evidence to point of clarity, which Ms. Scott mentioned in her legal submissions as well, which is, in my opinion, the heritage landscapes are necessary, and they do provide additional regulation and controls that the underlying rural zone doesn't provide, such as stopping the destruction of unlisted tracks, mines, structures, buildings. Those sorts of things aren't actually dealt with through the underlying rural zone. Following on number 6, Mr. Irving considers there is scope to refer to the key features to be protected, which is Rule 26.6.21. I support this change on the merits. Furthermore, I note that Tungsten Mining Limited submission does not appear to be constrained only to the Rural Heritage Landscape, and therefore this and any other rule amendments stemming from the submission should apply to all heritage landscapes.
I think on the issue of heritage landscapes, it would be useful to advise people that back in prehistory, when I did my town planning degree, my research essay was on heritage landscapes and creating provisions in district schemes to provide for them. So I understand those, and it's probably fair to make that known to people. And I should probably also mention that I'm a member of ICOMOS, which may not be readily apparent.
Turning to Ms. Gillies' evidence, to make a comment that I accept within a number of the suggestions and points she raises. One being, she suggests the removal of the word destruction within the rule demolition, demolition and destruction, which is quite common terminology used in heritage planning. But I do agree with her that I don't see that it adds a lot when you're talking destruction of an archaeological site is different, but destruction of a built item. So I would agree with her in terms of removing that word destruction where it appears in relation to the demolition of an item or a feature. She suggests adding the proviso that exists under policy 26.5 6.1.6. She suggests also adding that to policy 26.5.1.5C and 26.5.1.8, and that's in her paragraph 6.3. And that is the wording of that proviso, I'm not sure that's the word she uses, so we'll just stick with that. But it simply says applicants will be required to show that the above options have all been investigated, and this is the whole concept of investigating all possible other alternatives before perhaps demolition or whatever it may be. And she's obviously sees merit in stating that very clearly under the policy. In terms of her, she seems to be linked to the term heritage fabric, as I think Mr. Knox discussed as well. I see merit in including the bullet points. Although I do understand your concerns, but I prefer our proposed version that sits within Appendix 1 in that respect. And did you want me to go through the bits of a dozen things that I don't agree with? Is that useful to front foot that? Or?
I think we'll just presume that everything you haven't mentioned you don't agree with.
It's one thing maybe.
There may be more that comes out of questioning that might be more sensible for you to deal with it in your reply.
There's one potentially the scope issue that was I think referred to, alluded to by Mr. Knott in terms of some of the changes to the categories that she suggests.
We noted that the two particular parts of her evidence seem to be out of scope. Which is in PC
30
the Masonic Lodge in Arrowtown that she never included in her original submission.
There was the Skipper's Road and the Franklin Boat Shed. And then if you want to know, she also discusses the issue of the demolition and relocation being included within a single rule. And if you want more information on that, I can give you more in terms of things. A little bit of misunderstanding around all of that, so I can explain that if you want. In terms of my evidence, I just wish to note, in terms of any changes to my own evidence, and a very, very, very minor point, is in my, on page 43, paragraph 18.3, I discuss the issue of having to replace asbestos-containing products with asbestos-containing products, and I refer to, I think it's the ED site, website for some information on that, and I just simply note that I understand the government has now banned the importation of asbestos, so just to be clear on that playing field has changed slightly in the last month. And in terms of my evidence, I would take on board, in terms of my paragraph 21.15, I would take on the changes to the categories that Mr. Knott has now made to his evidence in terms of items 59 and 101, the meals and the parish.
I think it might be wise to take morning adjournment before we start questioning. And we will adjourn now and reconvene at 20, sorry,